The hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I'll call this meeting of the House Ag Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order. We have a quorum. Thank you. And with that, having looked at the minutes, who would offer to move the minutes? Representative Nelson.
Yeah, I would move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Any discussion on those amendments or on those minutes? If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. We have a pretty full agenda today, folks, and just a heads up that if we don't finish, we have the room reserved again for later this afternoon. Hopefully we won't need that, but a lot of information to get over, and we want to get finished with today's agenda. First up, it's a great week. See all the blue jackets around the Capitol and in the office building. We're going to hear from some state FFA officers, and here they are. Welcome. So tell us who you are, identify yourself for the record, and then tell us about your experience with FFA. Go ahead.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Natalie Clemenson, and I'm currently serving as the Minnesota FFA state reporter.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Kaya Grossman, and I'm currently serving as the Minnesota FFA state secretary this year.
It truly is a pleasure to be here with you all today. Kaya and I are just kind of going to share our stories and how FFA has impacted us and a little bit of our background. So I have grown up on my family's dairy crop and beef farm just outside of Zimbrota, Minnesota. So I had developed a passion for agriculture early on, working on the farm, being involved with it every day. So that was kind of my draw into FFA, was seeing the opportunities that I could expand my knowledge of agriculture with, participating in the dairy judging career development event, showing my dairy heifers at the state fair and opportunities like that. But what truly made me stay was the connections I was making and the opportunities it allowed me to have to grow as a leader. FFA is unlike other school activities such as sports, or organizations, it's an intracurricular. So FFA members have to be enrolled in an agriculture education class in order to be an FFA member. These classes allow students to expand their knowledge of agriculture and explore the wide varieties of realms of careers and opportunities that they can see themselves within in agriculture in the future. Minnesota FFA offers 29 career and leadership development events to their students. These are contests that students can participate in to build their skills and knowledge of agriculture and leadership. Some of these include forestry, ag mechanics, livestock evaluation, meats judging, as well as the leadership side of things. So prepared public speaking, extemp speaking, and parliamentary procedure, which they can use in any career that they choose to pursue. And then another part of FFA that my life has touched is the supervised agricultural experiences. So these are work-based learning projects that students participate in to gain that hands-on experience for their future careers. Personally, mine has been placement on my family's dairy farm as well as entrepreneurship. So I bought my first heifer in 2018 and have expanded my herd to 7 since then. And it's just really taught me financial skills, time management, and cooperation that I'm going to be able to use in my future as I pursue a dairy science degree.
My name is Kaya. No, you're completely fine. You're completely fine. I tell people if they forget it, think of a karate chop like Kaya, but with a K, Kaya. Usually it helps people remember. Natalie talked about growing up on her dairy operation. My story is just a little bit different. It's a little bit more untraditional for an FFA member. I'm from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, so I grew up surrounded by trees and lakes. That's about as far as my extent of agriculture goes. I never lived on a farm. My family never owned a farm, nothing like that. I was actually the shyest kid ever. I went into high school. I was so shy. Even my agricultural education teacher, he called me Kayla, the entire freshman year because I was too shy to correct him. I actually didn't even join FFA until my sophomore year, so I only spent 3 short years in the classroom FFA setting. But in those 3 short years, I grew so much. I was pushed into the forestry contest, of course, being from northern Minnesota. I joined parliamentary procedure, and through different conferences, like the one we're currently leading, the agricultural policy experience, I found my voice, my passion, and that's what we do in FFA. We grow leaders. We help them find their voice, and we're going to grow the leaders that hopefully are taking your guys' seats on this committee one day, speaking up for the future of agriculture in Minnesota. So tomorrow we're going to have around 375 FFA Blue Jackets walk here on the Capitol, meeting with different legislators advocating for agriculture. So if you see us, make sure to stop us. We're here to chat with you guys. Say hi. They have some really cool stories to share. I know I'm not from agriculture. I'm not really going into agriculture. I'm at the University of North Dakota in my freshman year studying political science. Although I hope to bring agriculture with me into the future, I know there's people out there with some really strong agricultural stories that they can share with you guys tomorrow and help your work on this committee. And I know that with the strength of the House of the Minnesota House of Representatives and the leadership of the FFA, we're going to pave a really bright future for the for agriculture in Minnesota. So I don't want to take up all your time. Natalie and I could sit here and talk to you guys all day, but thank you guys for having us, and I hope the rest of your work today goes well.
Well, Kaya, thank you very much. And Natalie, same to you. Any questions from members before we move on? It always is amazing how you folks in Blue Jackets can speak so well with adults. I didn't think you had any notes there either, so congratulations on how you relate to adults and get your message across, and thank you very much for that.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And moving on, next we have the Office of Legislative Auditor, the report on bioincentive and biofuel infrastructure grant programs. So could those folks come to the testifier table and begin their report to Lori Lason and Valencia Stone. Get you all hooked up there and go on with the report. So I won't guess which one's first, so why don't you identify yourselves and begin your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Lori Lyson. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We're going to talk about our performance audit at the Department of Agriculture. And what we focused on here was 2 programs. One is an incentive program and one is a grant program. The incentive program is monetary incentives to producers of commercial scale production of renewable energy and renewable chemicals. And then the grant program is focused on retail fueling stations to install or upgrade their equipment so that they're able to dispense fuel with at least 15% ethanol. So what we did is not only did we look at the Department of Agriculture's kind of oversight over these 2 programs, but then we also actually did site visits as well. So we went out to producers and we also looked at retailers. So our results here is that for the incentive program, we didn't have any findings. It was operating well and we had no concerns there. But we did have 2 findings for the grant program. And those 2 findings Ms. Stone will talk about further. But I think one thing to note here is if you follow any of our reports and you've seen some of the grant reports we've done before, we often times have a lot of findings related to grants. But what the Department of Agriculture did well is they had a few things that were in place that we don't always see. One of those things is they don't advance money ahead of time. They have a 10% retainage. And what we also saw is that they actually went on site to their grantees. So they physically went there before they made that final payment. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Stone, who will go in more in depth about the programs. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Valentina Stone, and I was a manager on this project. Today, I'm happy to present at the results of the audit of the incentives and grants for renewable energy and renewable chemical programs. the Minnesota Department of Agriculture oversees the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Program. This program contains approximately a dozen different programs that provide various financial assistance. And within those that dozen of programs, there are two distinct programs that are specifically designated for renewable energy and renewable chemicals. The first one is bioincentive program, and the purpose of this program is to issue, as Ms. Lyson mentioned, incentive payments to producers for production of renewable chemicals and renewable energy. And the second program is Biofuels Infrastructure Grant Program that provides competitive grants for equipment to dispense those biofuels. The objectives of our audit were to determine if the department complied with applicable legal requirements and if the department had sufficient controls to ensure that the department indeed complied with those requirements. During our audit period, we looked at the activity that took place between July 1st, 2021 through January 31st, 2024. To participate in bioincentive program, the production facilities must meet certain requirements. First, the production facilities must be located in Minnesota. The producers must meet the minimum quarterly production volumes of qualified renewable energy or renewable chemicals, and they must use locally sourced biomass. It is important to note that in order to participate in this program, producers typically need to invest in process improvements or purchase of additional new equipment. And we also outline detailed eligibility requirements for this program in Exhibit 6 on page 16 of our report. During our audit period, MDA made incentive payments for the production of advanced biofuel, biomass thermal energy, and renewable chemicals. There were six producers that produced ethanol from corn kernel fiber, and also those producers produced renewable natural gas from a dairy manure collected from the dairy farms. There were another five producers that produced the heat from wood chips, and a single producer that produced a renewable chemical called dissolvable wood pulp, which is produced from wood chips as well. During our audit period, the department paid a little over $12 million in those incentive payments. And as you can see in this exhibit, almost half of that went to a single producer that produced dissolvable wood pulp. In this exhibit, we show the comparison between claims that the producers submitted and the payments that those producers received from the department. And as you can see, the amount of claims significantly exceeded the amount available funding. And as Ms. Lyson mentioned, we completed our audit work on this program and we didn't find anything out of compliance for the department. We did not have any written findings. The second program that we looked at was Biofuels Infrastructure Grant Program. And in order to participate in this program, applicant must meet specific requirements. First of all, they have to be located in Minnesota. They should have no more than 10 retail fueling stations, and they also have to be licensed and authorized to conduct business in the state. In 2022, the department awarded $6.48 million for 44 different projects. And as of the end of our audit period, which was January 31st, 2024, The department paid approximately $2.33 million for 15 completed projects. And as Ms. Lyson mentioned, department did not make any advance payments to any of the producers. Based on our audit work, we determined that the department generally complied and generally had adequate controls over this grant program. We did, however, identify two areas for the improvement. We found that the department paid approximately $19,000 for costs not associated with the purchase or installation of qualified equipment. And in our report, we recommended that the department should recoup this money from the grantee. We also found that the department paid approximately $358,000 for costs not included in the grant budgets. For example, for payments to vendors that were not specified in the grant budgets, or in the amounts different, or in the amounts that deviated from the budgeted amounts. We also found the department paid approximately $13,000 to a single grantee for the equipment that that grantee ordered before the contract was executed. The other area where we found some noncompliance was related to the program reports for the grant. So we found that Minnesota Department of Agriculture did not obtain all required progress reports from their grantees. The department required all grantees to submit progress reports on the status of their projects starting in the fall 2022 through the fall 2026. Even if grantee completed the project in 2022, the department still required the grantees to report on the marketing plans and to report the fuel sales. So we found that none of the grantees submitted reports in fall 2022, and 27 out of 44 grantees did not submit those required reports in 2023. We also observed that even if grantees submitted those reports were not sufficient to describe the status of the project. So the department provided the templates to grantees to submit those progress reports, but those templates only asked if grantees completed the projects, but didn't ask where in the project the grantees were. When we followed up with the grantees, we discovered that two grantees were no longer planning to do any work on the projects because it became way too expensive for them. And we recommend that the department should obtain all the required grant progress reports, and the department should not make any payments until they receive those progress reports. This concludes my presentation, and Ms. Lyson and myself will be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. So I'm in my third year on the Legislative Audit Commission, and this is one of the cleanest reports that I've ever seen. So kudos to the Department of Agriculture. There's a couple things that need to be looked into, and I'm sure they will, but from a financial impact standpoint, this is really good to see words like MDA complied with program requirements, MDA had adequate internal controls. That is just really good to see. So more of a comment, no questions.
Thanks, Representative. Any other comments, questions, praise? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would concur with Representative Jacob. We hear a lot of reports, and this was a good one. I do have a question about the two findings on the required reports from fall of 22 and 23. Did they ever submit, did people ever submit those reports later on, or are they still not out there?
Ms. Lyson, Ms. Stone, either one of you? Ms. Stone.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, yes, those grantees submitted reports later in 2024. But we did have instance where one grantee completed the project right away when they received the money in 2022, and they have not submitted any reports in 2023 and 2024.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then what happens then if they don't submit the required report?
Ms. Stone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, typically, according to the grants Office of the Grants Management Policy, if the grantees do not submit progress reports, the agency should withhold funding from them and not make any payments.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks, both of you, for a pretty good report. So thank you. Next up, we have from the Department of Agriculture, Deputy Commissioner Andrea Vobel. And congratulations on getting a star on the report.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. First of all, I just wanted to, for the record, my name is Andrea Vobel. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I first want to say a big thank you to the OLA staff throughout the process. They were constructive, respectful, and asked great questions. These are complicated and technically complex programs, as many of you are aware and familiar with these programs. We appreciate the recommendations in the report and take them very seriously. We generally agree with the findings and will promptly address the recommendations. We are confident in our procedures and welcomed this audit as an opportunity for continuous improvement. We're very proud of the way we've implemented these programs. The OLA reviewed roughly $14.5 million in expenditures between the two programs. Of that amount, only $18,894 is recommended to be reclaimed. That's just over 0.1% of the reviewed expenditures. We have followed the OLA recommendation to reclaim those funds, and I'm pleased to share with the committee that the majority of that amount has been received by MDA from the grantees. It's worth highlighting that we processed $12.1 million in bioincentive payments during the audit period, and there were no findings. This is a complex program, including three different categories, each with its own eligibility requirements and funding formula. There are only two findings related to the Biofuels Infrastructure Program, or BIP, grants, even though this was a new program, and the review period covered the first round of grants we awarded. The total amount of BIP payments that OLA recommends the MDA reclaim is less than 1% of payments made during the audit performance period. We're proud of our ability to roll out new programs that make a difference to Minnesotans and Minnesota businesses in a timely manner. The performance period reviewed overlapped with the period of time when the grants team was also administering $8 million of time-sensitive drought relief payments. I'd also like to point out that our grants team consistently exceeds the Office of Grants Management requirements, as the OLA pointed out. We reconcile every payment request. That means we review source documentation for every payment request by reviewing invoices for all purchases and ensuring that the vendors have been paid. The Office of Grants Management only requires that agencies review one payment request on a grant of more than $50,000. For payment requests for more than $25,000, we have two staff members review and sign off on the payment. This is also not required by the office. We make site visits on every grant over $25,000, even though the Office of Grants Management only requires site visits on grants over $50,000. In keeping with the theme of MDA's commitment to being responsible stewards of public money, I'm pleased to share news that we've hired an agency-wide compliance coordinator, and his name is Fakada, and he's here in the audience if he just wants to wave. He's here with us this afternoon. He reports directly to the commissioner's office and will be reviewing MDA's programs and procedures to ensure that they are being managed and implemented in accordance with state law and policies. We've also recently hired an agency-wide grants coordinator. She also reports directly to the commissioner's office and is responsible for providing technical assistance and guidance to our grant administration staff and will ensure that our grant administration processes and procedures are sound and consistent from program to program. I also did just want to take a quick point of personal privilege. In what is a time now where public servants aren't necessarily painted in a really complimentary way, I wanted to take a moment to thank those who have devoted their lives to public service. So many of them are here today in the audience. It is an honorable work. It is hard work. It is often thankless and misunderstood. But it matters, and it makes our communities and the lives of Minnesotans better. And we at MDA are very, very grateful. I'm proud to serve among such dedicated, smart, and passionate people.
Once again, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the OLA report. We are proud of this report and how we administer these important programs. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Vobel. Comments, questions from members of the committee? Going once, no. You can stay there. Just an announcement that in your packets there's written testimony from both the Minnesota Corn Growers and the Minnesota Biofuels Association. So that testimony is in your packets. Take a look at it at your perusal. Now we're going to move to the budget items today. The Department of Agriculture, and we'll hear from Ms. Vobel, also Carrie Suki with the department. So go ahead, identify yourselves again for the record and proceed with your budget suggestions for the year. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Andrea Vobel. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department Agriculture, and I'm joined here by our Director of Government Relations, Michelle Medina. I am just extending regrets from our fearless leader, Commissioner Tom Peterson. He is in Washington, D.C. right now with the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, talking about the many programs on a federal level that are important to the workings of MDA. Just around 10% of our budget is federally funded, so it's important that we keep those things moving, and he is making that case in D.C. as we speak. So we just like to, again, ground ourselves in the mission of the department, and that is to enhance all Minnesotans' quality of life by equitably ensuring the integrity of our food supply, the health of our environment, and the strength and resilience of our agriculture economy. Next slide. So we'll go through general fund budget requests. You will notice that most of these don't have necessarily a general fund fiscal impact, but these are included in our budget bills because they have some semblance of fiscal pieces to them. So in terms of spending for general fund, the governor's request is for $557,000 in fiscal year 26 and $1.127 million in each subsequent year from the general fund. This is to maintain the current level of service delivery at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. As many of you know, the cost of operations rises each year due to increases in employer-paid healthcare contributions and other operating costs like rent and lease, fuel and utilities, and IT and legal services. These costs do put pressure on agency operating budgets that remain flat from year to year. So you'll see in this request that is to help us with some of those operating pressures along with an increase to rent in our world-class lab building that we share with the Department of Health. Next, we have our food licensing modernization request. This is, you'll see, is a no funding change on a general fund side. We do are looking to amend our chapters 28A and 31 to modernize the MDA's food licensing framework. This is to simplify the administrative system for food licensing to allow for business evolution and innovation and to increase food license fees to maintain regulatory service levels in fiscal year 26 to 29. Again, like I said, it's to help simplify the administrative system. We also create a new licensing category for home food processors. Many of you are familiar with the cottage food producers program that we have. This is another step we'd like to create for those who are looking to make their way into the food business realm and have that extra step. And then again, it would increase the license fees to maintain our regulatory service levels. The last major modification to the agency's licensing fees was in 2003 or 21 years ago. I also just want to point out it's not a new program or initiative, but rather a simplification to an administrative component of the current food licensing law we've had here at the department. Next is our livestock investment grant expansion. Again, you'll see there's no funding change. This is changes to an existing program that we have at the department under the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Program, or AGRI. Many of you are familiar with it. So the livestock investment grant does expand the eligibility of what we're looking to do is expand the eligibility of the livestock investment grant to include tribal governments and local units of government. We also broaden the definition of livestock. Currently, the primary species raised in the state are included, things like farm cervidae, cattle, dairy, swine, poultry, goats, beef cattle, llamas, horses, sheep, bison. But it does exclude other livestock that pose significant opportunity and are usually raised by small and beginning farmers. So we'd hope to update the language that other livestock species such as rabbits, donkeys, alpacas, and aquaculture are also eligible under the livestock investment grant. Finally, under our current policy, grants are limited to just 10% of the first $500,000 of qualifying expenditures. We've had significant producer feedback on this, as well as things that came into our public portal that reinforced the importance of this program, but highlighted the need to adjust the matching requirements. So that's part of this proposal as well. Sorry, I'm trying to go fast because I know we got things to go through. Agri-admin allowance, again, this is no general fund budget change, but this is to increase the maximum administrative allowance for the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Program out of 41A. That is, we would like to increase it to 7.5% from 6.5%. This recommendation is being made for a number of reasons. Many of you are familiar with the new grant requirements that were adopted during the 2023 legislative session. We also have, as you can tell from the previous presentation, we have a significant commitment to meeting and exceeding the Office of Grants Management requirements. We also have a number of very small grants that we administer, and the number of first-time grantees Agri staff work with has increased significantly. Some of the additional requirements that are on our staff right now are include increased pre-award risk assessments, such as reviewing grantee history and capacity, state and federal tax forms, financial statements, certified financial audits, internal control procedures, and post-award evaluations. These, again, all require significant staff resources to do. Next one is our grain license fees update. So this, again, there's no funding change here in terms of general fund spending. It does adjust the fee schedule for entities licensing as grain buyers under 223 or grain storage facilities under 232. So we have not, these licenses have not had a significant adjustment to their fee schedule in 20 years, so since 2005, but they have seen some cost savings through the repeal of some bonding requirements. So the previous fee structure was put in place before the new language was added in 2019, which requires every facility to be inspected once annually. So our costs have increased for that, and we want to make sure that the fee schedule reflects that. Next one is our Agri-Biofuels Infrastructure Grant. Again, no funding change here, but this Biofuels Infrastructure Grant, as discussed in the previous presentation, is under the Agri umbrella. This modifies the eligibility requirements for the Agri-Biofuels Infrastructure Grant Program by increasing the maximum number of retail petroleum dispensing sites owned by a prospective grantee from 10 to 20. We believe that the rounds of funding that have made a significant dent in the number of eligible applicants with 10 or fewer retail locations around the state. And we feel like this is a good timing for the expansion to 11 to 20. This change to a 20-site maximum on eligible businesses would allow additional farm cooperatives to be eligible for the program as well, because many of these cooperatives fall just outside the current 10-site limit. Also under Agri, the urban ag expansion. So this again is no funding change. This proposal broadens the eligible uses of grant funds to include agriculture-based trainings, acceleration and employment programs, and urban agriculture processing. Current grant eligibility focuses only on urban youth ag education or urban ag community development grants. We got a significant increase in funding levels for this program in the past couple of years, which has been wonderful, but it's been difficult for us to spend these funds on strong projects, and many of the grantees have been funded for multiple years. So the 24-25 fiscal year budget rider allocates $2 million per year for urban ag projects. We did increase the maximum award amount from $50,000 to $100,000, but we were unable to use all of the funds because of the limited qualified applicant pool. In 2024, we received 80 applications and funded 29 proposals. Of these proposals, 6 were previously funded. Since the program's inception in fiscal year 2018, 18.75% of our grantees have received at least 2 or more awards. Expanded eligibility criteria will strengthen the applicant pool, diversify projects, and support additional urban ag efforts throughout Minnesota. Our Good Food Access Program update. Again, no funding change here, but requesting some changes within the program itself. So the Good Food Access Program was created to better equip the program. The proposal is to better equip the program to fulfill its mission to increase the availability of and access to affordable, nutritious, and culturally appropriate food, including fresh fruits and vegetables for underserved communities. So the current statute contains rigid detail resulting in complex requests for proposals or RFPs that are challenging for applicants to navigate and determine their eligibility. This complexity often limits access for smaller or resource-strapped food retailers and culturally appropriate food, and those that are often best positioned to deliver nutritious and culturally appropriate food to communities in need, and many of which do not have professional grant writers on staff. One other piece that we've heard throughout the life of this program is that the title of the program, Good Food Access Program, has also presented some challenges during our statewide implementation of the program. By suggesting that certain foods are inherently good, it is unintentionally implying that others are bad, which has created a stigma, especially amongst rural communities. This negative perception frames the program as being overly idealistic or disconnected from local food preferences. We have a great Good Food Access Advisory Committee. They have suggested to call it now the Food Retail Improvement and Development Program, or FRIDGE. Next is a seed potato certification statute modernization. Again, no funding change here, but it modifies several provisions which will be cumulatively budget neutral. So this recommendation repeals Minnesota Statute 21.116, which prohibits the use of any general fund towards the program. This is a prohibition that does not exist for any related industries and creates financial risk for the program. With a limited number of participants in the program, if an unexpected downturn in the industry or major program expense occurred, it could quickly lead to insolvency for the program. The ability to lean on general funds if such an emergency occurred would add stability for the program and the industry. The MDA is not requesting a general fund appropriation, but is simply asking to remove the prohibition from using general funds toward the program if necessary. In Minnesota, there are about 25 producers of seed potatoes. When seed potatoes are certified, it means that they meet standards for freedom from disease. Planting certified seed potatoes is generally desirable for growers and required in some situations. Standards for seed potato certification are standardized amongst potato-growing states, and over time, those standards change to reflect changes in the industry. Milk marketing modernization. No funding change here, but the proposal is to modernize the requirements for licensing entities that purchase milk directly from Minnesota dairy producers to provide more accountability to these entities. So most Minnesota dairy producers sell their milk to other business entities, such as dairy processors or milk marketing organizations. These entities may use the milk in their processing plant or further market it on behalf of the dairy producer. In recent years, the MDA has been made aware of several situations where dairy producers have not been paid for milk collected from their farms. In the follow-up to these situations, the MDA identified that the requirements for these entities need to be modernized. This recommendation makes several statutory changes as they relate to milk marketing licenses. These include eliminating the milk marketing organization category, adding a definition for milk marketer to include any entity who purchases milk from Minnesota dairy producers, except for if they are acting solely as a broker and not a party to the contract or accepting payment on behalf of the producer. Requires any entity meeting the criteria for milk marketer to obtain a license. Requires fiscal reporting for payments made to Minnesota producers and milk collected from farms. Includes a scale fee of $75 for entities collecting 700,000 pounds of milk or less directly from dairy producers during the previous 12 months or for an initial license. The fee is $250 for entities collecting more than 700,000 pounds of milk directly from dairy producers in the previous 12 months and establishes a penalty of $250 for purchasing milk from dairy producers without first obtaining a license. Seed tonnage reporting frequency reduction. Again, no funding change here. This just reduces the number of times seed labeling permit holders report and pay tonnage fees from 4 per year to 2 per year. Again, seed permit holders currently report sales of seed 4 times per year and pay fees associated with those sales as outlined in Minnesota Statute Chapter 21. The governor's recommendation amends language to permit fewer reporting periods during the course of the year. Reducing the number of times that permit holders will need to report seed sales and pay fees will reduce the administrative burden for both permit holders and the MDA. The language proposed maintains flexibility for permit holders so that if alternative reporting schedule works better for the permit holder, it is possible to adopt that with the consent of the MDA. PFAS language alignment. Again, no funding change here. This proposal aligns PFAS language in Minnesota Statute 18B with Minnesota Statute Chapter 116 regarding product prohibitions for certain categories. This proposal may result in a small number of products that may be prohibited from registering or renewing. This is one just to note that we are working closely with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on. So the current language in 18B regarding the prohibition of cleaning products contained intentionally added PFAS on January 1st, 2026 was intended to reflect the language in Minnesota Statute Chapter 116 regarding product prohibitions for certain categories that take effect on January 1st, 2025 for the MPCA. Current language in Chapter 18B only refers to cleaning products, but should include all applicable categories listed in Chapter 116, such as fabric treatments. Absence of language regarding the additional categories leaves a loophole that may be exploited to register pesticide products, which may fall within 116.943, Subdivision 5A. This proposal may result in a small number of products that may be prohibited again from registering or renewing. Rural Finance Authority program updates. Again, no funding change here, just changes to within the current program structure. Focuses on several programs under the Rural Finance Authority. The first is changes to the encumbrance timeline from 2 years to 6 months for the down payment assistance grant program. This changes the amount of time that funds would be encumbered from 2 years to 6 months. 6 months would be a more practical time period and allow funds not to be tied up unnecessarily. Land purchase transactions do not take 2 years to close once a purchase agreement is signed. We'd also like to update the Farm Opportunity Loan Program. That program was established in 2015, and since that time, two of the primary categories are so broad that almost any farm practice or machinery could fall under the definition. The MDA has a robust revolving loan account that can provide funds for the line items the RFA is looking to delete. That's in the AgBNP loan program. Also, a net worth limit is being proposed to ensure the limited revolving funds get to the Minnesota farmers that need it most. Setting a qualifying net worth limit for the disaster loan program is another part of the proposal. The RFA revolving loan program consists of 8 separate programs that are funded out of a shared pool of money around $9.3 million. Ensuring that these limited funds go to the most financially challenged Minnesota farmers during declared disasters helps keep money in the account available to lend during disasters when it is needed most. The RFA also does not want to compete with local banks for loans they might disperse for higher value clients. We're also looking to have the RFA applications for bond-funded programs be for at least $50,000. The RFA recommends that loan minimums be established on all RFA bond-funded loan programs at $50,000 each. These loans are funded through an authorization from the legislature to sell bonds for the purposes of making loans to Minnesota farmers. This is not a request for funds, just a request to set a minimum loan limit to ensure the administrative time used to process loans is effectual. The programs that would be affected are Beginning Farmer Loan Program, Seller Sponsored Loan Program, Ag Improvement Loan Program, Livestock Expansion Loan Program, and the Restructured 2 Loan Program. The RFA does not receive many requests for loans under this limit, but keeping the programs well attuned to the marketplace is always a best practice. And then finally, we are looking to update the pilot agricultural microloan program by removing the word pilot and adding land as an eligible for financing. The pilot agricultural microloan program was enacted actually in 2012, and we're looking to remove the word pilot from the name of the program and statute, as to us, this is not a pilot program any longer and has proven as a useful tool to help emerging and specialty farmers get access to credit. The RFA is also looking to add the purchase of land to the eligible uses of the loan funds. One of the most significant obstacles emerging farmers in Minnesota face is the access to land. Being able to use the funds from this program in order to assist in the purchase of land can go a long way in supporting emerging farmers in getting a true foothold in agriculture.
Ms. Vaub, I'll give you a chance to catch your breath here for a second. Good job. Just a quick question. You said the definition of family member was changing. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes. And I think... Oh, is Jenny Heck here or Matt? I don't see. Okay. There's Matt. There he is.
Okay.
I'm going to just phone a friend here quick.
Sure. If you want to go on to your next piece and as he makes his way up here.
That sounds great.
Come on up. Yeah.
So I'll just get into the AgBNP program updates and then we'll let Matt go to the question. So again, AgBNP program updates, no funding change to this. This focuses on several aspects of the Agricultural Best Management Practices or AgBNP program. It increases the allowable amount the AgBNP program is allowed to appropriate and administer from $140 million to $280 million and deletes rural from the AgBNP loan eligibility requirement. This is not a request for additional equipment, supplies, administration costs, or a change of use from previous years. Deleting rural from the AgBNP loan eligibility requirement will largely allow for loans that prevent, reduce, or eliminate environmental pollution, provide climate change benefit, or improve drinking water in areas of the state that tend to be less populated or developed but aren't technically defined as rural. This is, and as I mentioned, not a request for additional funds. And I'll let Mr. McDevitt introduce
again,
himself.
The question was the definition change of family member from the previous slide. Identify yourself and go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Matt McDevitt. I'm the finance supervisor for the Rural Finance Authority and run the AgBNP loan program as well. So the family part there, we just were really trying to get a very firm definition. It kind of seems to change in you know, how people want to go about this, but we just want to make sure it's extremely specific, you know, whether it's, you know, once or twice removed by blood or whatever the case may be. You know, this is one of those things that over the last couple of years has kind of been debated, and it kind of moves around. It's kind of a moving target on exactly what it is. And we're not even, I don't think we're even really necessarily suggesting it has to be a certain way. We just want it very specific so that when people are saying, hey, what does it mean by family member? You know, what does it mean? And there's no ambiguity mixed in with it.
So do you have that specific definition?
Do we
in
have
mind?
That? What it exactly, how it exactly states right now? Do you know what it is offhand? Okay. We would have to get back to you on exactly how it is sitting at this moment.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. McDevitt. Back to Ms. Vabel, green fertilizer.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, so this proposal is for a $3 million reduction to the Green Fertilizer Grant Program. That program was authorized under last year and in 2023, I'm sorry, 2 years ago, in 2023. It was a one-time appropriation of $7 million, and that was made to the MDA for grants to agricultural or rural electric cooperatives to invest in green fertilizer production facilities. So this one-time $7 million appropriation is available until the year 2032, and the $3 million reduction leaves $4 million available for grants to cooperatives. For those who aren't familiar, green fertilizers are nitrogen-based fertilizers produced from water, air, and renewable energy. And green fertilizer is a pretty new technology, and there are no currently green fertilizer production facilities in the state, in the state of Minnesota currently. However, we are aware of numerous cooperatives that have expressed interest in applying for these grant funds. Unfortunately, given the state's budget forecast, the MDA considered a multitude of cost reduction options while prioritizing the agency's core mission. Reducing funding for a new grant program with unspent funds is one option to reduce agency costs while minimizing service impacts to Minnesotans and establish agency programs. And then finally, we just wanted to highlight another part of the governor's budget request is $5.3 million in fiscal year 26 and 27 and $2.1 million in each fiscal year thereafter on top of the current appropriation for sustainable aviation fuel. You'll recall this will be carried in the Department of Revenue's bill in the tax committee, but an important piece for agriculture that we wanted to highlight. The other piece we just wanted to make folks aware of is our clean water budget proposals, just so you have some awareness around some other pieces where we use for funding the operations and the work of the agency. So we won't get into all of them. I'll just list them very quickly. Our Forever Green Initiative, appropriation of $6 million for fiscal year 26-27. Our Irrigation Water Quality Protection Program, an appropriation of $310,000. Monitoring for pesticides in surface water and groundwater, appropriation of $740,000. Our nitrate and groundwater program, that's appropriation of $6.2 million. Our pesticide testing of private wells program, appropriation of $1 million. A technical assistance program is $3.2 million, and I should mention these are proposals. We have a proposal to expand our Minnesota Ag Weather Station network, an appropriation of $2.5 million. Our AgBNP loan program, which I referenced earlier, a transfer of $4 million from the Clean Water Fund to our program account. Conservation equipment grants, or also known as our soil health equipment grants, that's an appropriation of $3.5 million. Our research inventory database is at $100,000. And then our ag water quality certification program with an appropriation of $7 million. And that is it, Mr. Chair. I tried to go very quickly, so there were time for questions and bills, but I really appreciate you hearing me out.
You did very well, very well. Questions from members? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation. Just quickly going back to page six, you briefly mentioned for the livestock investment grant expansion, the updating the match requirement. Can you just go back, tell us what is the current match requirement and what will be the new update to that? Thank you.
Ms. Bobble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lee. Great question. Yeah, so currently the grants are limited to just 10% of the first 500,000 of qualifying expenditures. So what we'd like to do is it'll be a tiered approach. So the state's investment would be 50% of the first 20,000 in qualifying expenses and 20% of the next 220,000 of qualifying expenditures.
No follow-up there. Representative Lawrence.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a follow-up with that question, but I do have a question on the same page.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the question, you're expanding the eligibility of these grants to local units of government. Could you expound on that for me a little bit as far as the necessity or the reasoning for that?
Ms. Vabel.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and I'm just going to pull up one of our fantastic staff folks just to make sure I get this right.
Okay. Welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Paul Hugan, and I'm the Director of the Ag Marketing Development Division at the Department of Agriculture. So that specific change of livestock investment grant mirrors something that we needed to change last year in the Sustainable Ag Development Grant Program. And in that case, what we had is folks doing research projects that were like soil and water conservation districts. We don't necessarily anticipate needing that for this particular grant program. It was more of a, let's make sure that we've got that in there in case we end up with a grant that matches eligible criteria. So we don't necessarily expect to use that. We just wanted to be consistent across our grant programs.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And so, and I guess what you've mentioned there sounds to me like two different processes, one being research and one being livestock investment. Maybe comment on that, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Lawrence. And that's right. The SUSTAG Development Grant Program is very much research-based. Livestock Investment Grant is not. This is for actual production of livestock facilities. We funded anything from fences to barns to watering equipment, et cetera. So it's a very different program.
Okay.
Another follow-up?
Mr. Chair, sure. Just as the final clarification, so other than, Mr. Chair, other than matching the other grant with this language, is there any purpose for having units of government in this part here in particular, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Huguenin?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Lawrence, we don't have an example of where that would be needed for this grant program. We didn't want to come back twice, come back 2 years from now and say, okay, now we've got a grantee that is technically ineligible, but yet we think that they meet the statutory intent. So we don't have a specific example where we would need that.
Okay, super. Thank you.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at page 14 as an example of a change that would reduce the number of times seed labeling permit holders have to report and pay tonnage fees from 4 per year to 2 per year. That's going in a really good direction. As I was door knocking all summer and into the fall, hearing from farmers that to some degree the regulatory environment on agriculture has become like collectively onerous for them. Could you touch on just in general some ways that you're maybe turning the dial back on some of the regulatory environment while still providing the necessary oversight? Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative, or I should say, Commissioner Vobel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gander, thank you for the question. I think this is something that we strive for all the time, is to find where we can find efficiencies, both for those that we serve and both for the folks who administer the programs. A lot of what we're focusing on right now is sort of modernizing both our technology systems, but again, sort of how we approach all of our regulatory duties, but also our grant-making abilities and all of those things. So it is a goal of ours to always be continuously improving and making sure that what we're offering and how we're providing these services to Minnesotans is easy to use, but also ensures that we're meeting our statutory responsibilities. So it's something we think about a lot and are thinking about in terms of process streamlining.
Representative Gander.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Vobel. I'm not sure if I caught this during here, but I want to go to the rent issue and the and I looked at the memo that's in the packet, and I'm still not clear exactly how much more the department's having to come up with to make the rent. And if that has to come out of existing budget or if you need additional money. Maybe just answering that question first and then follow up.
Ms. Vobel.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen. I just have to look here for the exact number of the increase. I know it's over, I think it's about $1.12 million in the outer years. The idea is that we would pay out of existing funds, and that's why we are asking for additional funding to be able to cover those things. The way that we pay our rent is currently it's out of the lab's general fund appropriation, and it is a fixed cost that we can't, you know, negotiate. That's just what it's got to be. So we either displace other things that the lab is doing, or we have to you know, ask other parts or other programs within our agency to provide those fundings. That means also other things that don't happen within the existing general fund appropriation. So for us, it is something that we are going to need on top to, in order for us to maintain our current services and meet the obligation of the rent.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the 2020 general obligation, they were GO bonds. Were those rates set in 2020? So maybe that's the first question.
Commissioner Vobel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I am going to just see if I can get some assistance from the Department of Administration, who owns our building.
Good questions, and we have expertise here. Welcome, identify yourself, and let's rephrase the question again, Representative Hansen, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the lab bonding from 2020, was that a fixed rate? So why is there an increase of, essentially, why is there an increase on the lab capital project if we had a fixed rate through bonding?
Identify yourself and then proceed to answer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Carrie Suki. I am the Facilities Management Director for the Department of Administration. So when there is a construction project in any of our buildings, we want to reflect all of those, the cost to back in our lease rates. That is one way to maximize federal funding and also to make sure that all of the expenses are shown in an agency's rental rates. So the project, it was funded in 2020. It's based on when the expenditures are made, that those costs then are depreciated over the life of the project, in this case, 30 years.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Representative Lee and the bonding committee, if that's a normal process on bond payments, but maybe that's something to look at. The bottom line question, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Vobel, is so if the department has to come up with 1.2 or 1.12?
1.12
out of existing funding, then that reduces the funding for other things. And is this a shortfall in the current fiscal year? If we had a deficiency payment of one-time general fund money, that would still allow existing funds to be spent. Is that correct?
Ms. Vobel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, if it was a one-time appropriation for this fiscal year, it would not solve the long-term problem of the existing sort of rent increase for the subsequent years, which is why we were asking for it to be ongoing in our proposal.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, so the 1.2 is, how many years is 1.2 million more then?
Ms. Suki.
Mr. Chair, members, so again, the project will be depreciated over 30 years, so this will impact the rates over for the full 30 years.
So roughly 30 plus million. Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, we probably need to spend a little more time on this, not right this moment, but I think that has some real consequences to program delivery. And if we can find some way of reducing that cost, that would limit program delivery. But I think, you know, hopefully that would be a bipartisan thing that we better take a look at if that's a long-term additional cost.
Thank you for that comment. Ms. Suki, I had a question as well. Used to more looking at depreciation schedules for business. And depreciation is a non-cash expense. So how do you figure depreciation on a state-owned building that doesn't really pay taxes as such? And where does that particular pile of money go? Ms. Suki.
Mr. Chair, in this case, so the buildings under admin's custodial control, they are owned by the state, so they are on the financial statement of MMB's financial statements. They're not on ours. So we depreciate them, and in our case, it is actually a cash transaction for depreciation. We send the funds over to the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. So I agree, usually depreciation is not a cash transaction, but in our case, for our lease fund, it is.
So, Ms. Suki, is that revenue accumulating in a dedicated account someplace, or is it used for other things as well?
Mr. Chair, most of that money goes back to the general fund at Minnesota Management and Budget. There are a few exceptions for Trunk Highway and a couple of other exceptions, but about 75% of it goes back to the general fund. And then, again, there's smaller portions that go elsewhere. But it all does transfer out of our lease budget.
Okay, thank you. And, yeah, I think we're going to take a further deep dive into this in a further committee meeting. But thank you for your testimony and for shedding some light on this complicated topic. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Ms. Vabel, wrap up, wind up, what?
Yes, nothing else from here.
And no further questions by committee members? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I think that leaves us with a bill to consider, and we'll do some chair hopping here and continue on.
Okay, our next item of business is House File 1063. Chair Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, yes, I'd like to move House File 1063.
Chair Anderson moves that House File 1063 be referred to the General Register. Chair Anderson, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this is a bill that we hope we can act expeditiously on. It was heard in the Senate last week. It's going to be on the Senate floor, I believe, on Thursday. And it addresses a concern of a lot of small businesses in Minnesota, namely small grain purchasing operations, small grain elevators that are really kind of a lifeblood in a lot of our small towns throughout, especially greater Minnesota. And I think this bill strikes a balance between having an accounting system that provides adequate certainty of the finances, but it also strikes a balance of not being too aggressively expensive for our smaller elevators that find bills of whatever $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 annually for an audit or a review type thing very difficult to handle in their cash flow. So because of that, there's been a lot of work put into this. In fact, this bill, the same language, was around last year. It made it as far as conference committee, and at that point it was, for some reason, not in the final bill. But I strongly support the bill, Madam Chair, and have a couple of testifiers, including one that came from quite a distance today.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. So I have on the list three testifiers. The first one is... Okay, is Nick Milanowski from the department coming up? Is he? Okay. Please state your name for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and representatives. My name is Nick Milanowski. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I serve as the Fruit, Vegetable, and Grain Program Supervisor. I'm here to provide any technical guidance or interpretation of the language here, but I do want to preface that. This language came out of our grain advisory group. This is something that the agency helped to draft at the beginning of last session following the request from this legislative body in 2023. Seeking recommendations on financial reporting for grain buyers here in Minnesota.
Thank you for that. Our next testifier is Donovan Story, owner of the Feed Mill Incorporated in Barnesville, Minnesota. Oh, Representative Jacob, you have a question?
Yes, I do. So do you feel, are you confident that this language really is sufficient to adequately regulate the financials of elevators in the areas?
Go ahead, Nick.
Madam Chair and Representative Jacob. So what this language does is it allows us to accept different reporting structures for each of these grain buyers here in Minnesota. It sets thresholds by which they would have to report. $7.5 million and under would be a lesser financial report than what's currently required. Right now, that would be a reviewed financial statement. And under this language, it would allow smaller entities within the state to report compilations or tax basis financial statements. This would give the department the ability to monitor these program or these grain buyers from year to year, look at their financial position, adequately assess if we need to step in the event that there's an insolvency or their failure to pay elevators. We're confident that this language, with the required inspections that we're doing for each one of these facilities, would be a hand-in-glove approach that would allow us to step in and make necessary take necessary steps to intervene if there were a failure to pay or failure to on a grander level like an insolvency.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Welcome, Donovan Story. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm grateful to be here. For the record, my name is Donovan Story. I'd just like to share with you what my small business has been facing in our state. To start off, just a quick introduction. I'm 30 years old. I have a young family of five with another one on the way. And our little family owns a small business in the small town of Barnesville, Minnesota. This business is called the Feed Mill Incorporated. I'm lucky to have and lead four employees. Together, our little team serves about 500 customers, and most of these customers rely on us daily for their animal food supply. This is something I'm very passionate about. My employees and our customers make up a big family of its own, and it revolves entirely around agriculture, specifically raising and feeding animals. Among many other things, our primary job at the mill is to manufacture animal food and supplements and provide it to our customers. We consult with them as needed and provide the right products at the right time to ensure efficiency and resilience in their operations, whether they're big or small. What's different than what you might be picturing is we do this without shipping things in across states. We simply make it. To do that, we have to source a lot of different ingredients, mostly local, but a couple of these ingredients are grain. In order to buy grain in Minnesota, you have to have a grain buyer's license, something I'm well aware of. Every year at the end of June, we renew our grain buyer's license. This is just one of the many licenses we have to renew. I need to stop to clarify here. At the feed mill, we do not store anybody's grain. All grain is brought in one load at a time. It's paid for immediately, and it's used exclusively as an ingredient for animal food. This grain that we purchase has an annual average of $500,000. Back to the license renewal. Like every other year, I proceeded this year with the same steps outlined. These include paying the license fee, paying the exam fee, paying for our $100,000 grain bond, and paying our accountant to supply MDA with the financial review. I'd like to add that our accountant is a reputable local agency. They have multiple employees and two registered tax return preparers. This year, our grain license renewal was denied. Denied because of our financial review. I was told the review from our accountant had nothing particularly wrong with it, but it wasn't good enough because it wasn't from a CPA, a certified public accountant. I couldn't understand it right away. Nothing changed in the legislation, and nothing changed in the amount of grain we purchased. It was frustrating, but you know, I learned early on in this business that I have to be good at two things. One was keeping my customers happy, and two was solving problems. I looked at it like just another obstacle, a certified public accountant. How hard could it be? Well, it turns out it's really hard. After 5 months, I had so many refusals from so many agencies, I actually lost count. It was apparent these agencies definitely aren't looking for extra work. They're not interested in the extra headache. And by and large, it became clear that these reviews and the possible liabilities that come with them is something they tolerate. And they tolerate it with established customers that they are already working with. In December, I finally found one CPA from Wisconsin who was willing to do this review, and things were looking up. But it was pretty short-lived, as I learned a couple weeks in that this review was going to cost $18,000. To go from an expense that was costing $500 to $18,000 is disproportionate to the size of our business, and it's disproportionate to my customers, the number of them and the size they are, because I have to try to pass that cost on to them. On our best year, we're lucky to make that kind of profit, and if we do, we need it. We need it for repairs and maintenance and upgrades. Everything about the CPA version of a financial review has been extremely difficult, including acquiring financing for it. The time alone that I've spent away from the business trying to get this done is astronomical. During this process, of course, I reached out to MDA, and everyone I was able to reach there expressed their mutual resentment for the statute. However, the overwhelming response was, "This is how it is." On January 23rd, we received a cease and desist order. I didn't have the CPA review that the order was demanding, and we can't explain to 10,000 animals what a cease and desist order is, so I had no choice but to appeal it. I'm still not exactly sure what that means. I'm in a daunting place right now, and I have no idea what the future holds, but I can't let this be the obstacle that fails our customers. Or the whole reason I purchased the business. 4 years ago, my boss at the time was in a near-fatal car accident. I had to step up and fill both our positions and try to keep the operation going. Within a couple months, it became apparent that he wasn't going to be able to come back to the business, and we didn't have any prospective buyers. But I had worked here for years, and I had firsthand knowledge of just how critical the mill was for so many farm families. I was on a first-name basis with each of them, and I couldn't just walk away. So I got a loan and I bought the business. This is why I'm here. I need to bring into perspective how important small businesses like mine are in Minnesota. We have a huge impact on the local food supply. Over half of our customers are backyard operations, and I'm really proud of that. They raise and feed an amazing diversity of crops and animals. And they rely on us for so much more than just feed, advice, direction, sometimes just sympathy, things they can't get from a big franchise or a big box store. Ms. Clementson and Ms. Grossman from the FFA that were here today are a great example of sustainability in our state agriculture. And there's a real concern here. I'd imagine everyone in this room is aware how important new farmer recruitment is in Minnesota. Well, equally as important is young entrepreneurs and these small companies that service their farm operations. We fill an important gap, and it can't be replaced from the top down. They need us now, and they're going to need us in the future. I would like to remind all of us one last time that this is, in fact, an agency bill. MDA is the very department we have to provide our information to. They are the professionals that do this, and they are responsible for the whole purpose of these requirements. Each threshold tier in this bill is exactly how they want to do that. I'm here as a voice for my business and its customers, but there are many more. From 2020 to 2024 alone, at least 20 entities had to give up their license and their livelihood for the same reasons I'm explaining now. Many of us are too small to even be seen, but yet we're being categorized with all the giants. Do we need to be held accountable for our financial responsibilities? Absolutely. But it has to be in a way that we can actually obtain. Applying the same financial review standard to all grain buyers, regardless of their size, is an unjust application of the law. House Floor 1063 can resolve this. I ask that you please give it your full attention. Small grain buyers like myself, we need to be able to do what we do best, and we need a little bit of room to grow. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I'm going through a little sore throat here. Director Nick, does this language essentially loosen the standards for the financial reporting?
Madam Chair and Representative Vang, what this would do for entities that are buying under $7.5 million, they would still have to provide financial reports that contain certain key information that would allow the department to monitor their financial position. It does walk back the requirement from, as it stands today, a reviewed financial statement from a CPA down to a lesser financial statement, but would still be required to include that critical information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the department and I know the stakeholders who've done a lot of work to try to find language to see, you know, how we can right-size this. However, I remember this issue being brought up when we were first talking about the grain indemnity fund, which we've heard how farmers weren't getting paid by elevators because they all of a sudden ran into bankruptcies. And I think it is a little bit counterintuitive that especially this year when we talked a lot about holding our taxpaying dollars with more accountability, and yet we're looking at how we can loosen it up a little bit more in terms of the financial reportings. Especially we established a grain indemnity fund from the last biennium, and now we seem to be taking less accountability and making sure that these grain elevators are able to be solvent to make sure that farmers are getting paid. So I just want to be mindful of that and share a little bit of context, how, we were all for making sure that farmers are getting paid, and yet we are kind of going the sort of opposite direction on that end. So just wanted to speak to that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair, and thank you, Chair Anderson, for bringing this bill. And it's something that it's important. I've got a small elevator, much like what we had heard from the testifier here in my district, sharing these same concerns. We thought we had this fixed last year, and it fell apart in the end. But you stated you had what used to be a $500 report to send in, and all of a sudden it's $18,000. There's not that much margin. This is, if you want to kill mom and pop, small town, small community, just leave this stuff on, because this is hurting. And we can't do this in small town, making sure that, the customers oftentimes, I'm sure there's many different sizes, whether it's somebody with a few chickens in the backyard to maybe a larger farmer that feeds a couple hundred head of cattle or something. I don't know what all this customer base is, but, this is something that, unfortunately, it was kind of a knee-jerk reaction to something that happened in Ashby. And, try to correct it, which it was a terrible situation in Ashby. There was a lot of people that were out. But it was really put an undue burden on the wrong group of people, is my opinion. And, the service that is provided by these small elevators, if if these small grain buyers, the feed manufacturers, if they're not making a payment, that news gets around the coffee shop real fast. And you're the sellers that are going to be would be willing to sell to the testifiers' grain business, they're not going to be selling there anymore. And so I also think that there's the ability of the Department of Agriculture to look at finances and see that if there's issues that need to be stepped in and can require more more reporting, and I think that's important. But I think this is a good step to correct really an overstep in the process. So thank you, Chair Anderson, for bringing this forward. I encourage its passage.
Thank you, Representative Anderson, Nelson. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, Representative Vang, I take your comments seriously. And you mentioned the Grain Indemnity Fund, which you helped greatly get across that finish line. There is language in that new statute that allows the department to hold managers and board members of cooperatives and such accountable. And that was one other thing mentioned in this bill, that the department said that with the indemnity fund language, they felt comfortable that they had the ability to make sure that the GMs and board members are held accountable in a case where something like that may happen again. And again, I want to thank Mr. Story for his testimony. He came from Barnesville, which is a long ways away, and to tell you how this impacts him, I think it is a powerful story, and I just want to say thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Harder. So many of the producers in my district, I've got a lot of small and organic producers, and it seems like the current language as it was adopted, you know, the large elevators and large farmers, they can handle these kind of outlays of cash to make these kind of reports or audits happen. But essentially, is it my understanding that this new language would specifically benefit those small and organic producers, maybe even more than the large producers, or am I not understanding it correctly? Yes, for you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson or Donovan Story, who would like to address Representative Jacobs' question?
I'll take a chance, take a stab at it. I think one thing that this does, it takes away the requirement that it has to be a CPA that does the financial review. As Mr. Story mentioned, they're hard to find, and maybe don't want to take on something as small as his operation, and then the cost itself becomes in some cases prohibitive. So I think that's a big part of it. And then just lowering threshold for having to have that CPA do those audits. It's still going to be done by an accountant. In his case, somebody in town has a good reputation and I assume does good work, or he wouldn't be there anymore. So I'm confident that this provides enough of a safeguard that it'll keep our producers safe who patronize this type of elevator.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Representative Jacob?
It looked like maybe the testifier had a response too.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Rep Jacob. I don't have much more to add on that. That's
okay.
Yeah.
Very well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jacob. Next, we will move on to our next testifier. And that is Jim Falk of Falk Seed Farm. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Jim Falk, I'm testifying here with Minnesota Farmers Union. Chair Harder and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be able to testify before the committee in support of House File 1063. I'm Jim Falk, the fourth generation operator of family farm in Swift County. I farm with my wife, Karen, and my son, Andrew. I'm also the president of Falk Seed Farm, Inc., a seed processing facility in Swift County. And 2025 marks our 40th year in business. I've been a licensed grain buyer in Minnesota for 25 to 30 years, even though most of our business is related to seed production and seed processing. We are a seed cleaning facility, and we have the equipment that's often utilized to clean raw grain into a more refined final product that can then be used in a food processing facility. We are not your typical commercial grain buyer. We only work with a few specialty crops, and we never buy commercial grain or provide commercial storage. The changes to the reporting requirement in the grain buyer's license in Minnesota in 2019 threw a lot of the small operations like mine under the same umbrella as a typical commodity grain elevator and into the requirement of financial review. My financial review over the last couple years has cost our business about $7,000 a year. I just received my engagement letter from my accounting firm that's going to be doing my review for MDA, and it will be $7,400 this year. To be clear, my tax report has already been completed by my accountant, and this is a review of the same information. I've been a member of the MDA's Grain Advisory Group for the last few years, and I participated in a lot of the discussion about how the reporting changes in 2019 negatively affected small grain buyers. During my time as a licensed grain buyer, the annual reporting has generally been some sort of financial data, purchase reports, and at times a compilation of my tax report that my accountant could prepare for a fraction of the cost of a review. Again, MDA was still getting my information. The restrict reporting established in 2019 wasn't effective and didn't prevent failures. And I'm going to deviate from my statement here just a little bit because there was conversation about the grain indemnity fund and the reporting that was brought up, Representative Vang actually. And I just want to point out that all of the extra reporting put in 2019 did not stop the two largest failures that we had. In pipeline failed in 2021, global processing failed in 2022. And so it wasn't the reporting as much as the point is the reporting didn't prevent those failures. Those failures occurred regardless. And much credit has to go to everyone who participated in getting the grain indemnity fund established, because that's where the real protection is for farmers. So, continuing on here, the grain indemnity count was established, farmers are protected, and MDA will still collect financial data from grain buyers. MDA staff is professional. They provided the committee with a great deal of information, allowed for open discussion and ideas, researched what other states do, and have made the recommendations for the changes in reporting that are in House File 1063. I'm very much in support of this bill, and I hope you will all support the recommendations of the qualified staff at MDA. In addition, I understand this committee has provided support for beginning farmers and new crop development, like the programs of Forever Green that focused on crops like Kernza, for example. There's a group of farmers that have formed a co-op called Perennial Promise, and these folks are in support of this bill, as they will need to conform with the grain buyers' requirements as well. So small businesses like mine provide market opportunities that farmers will not get hauling their grain to a commercial elevator. Falk Seed has provided millions of dollars of premiums to farmers over our years in business. This year alone, we will exceed $350,000 in premium paid to farmers for grain and seed purchased. And I purchase so little grain in comparison to a commercial grain elevator that my yearly purchase wouldn't be what they would purchase in a day. Small businesses provide market opportunities and services that are often not provided by the largest grain buyers. To be clear, everyone will still be reporting. There's no lack of transparency, and remember, these are the recommendations of the people at MDA. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I really hope that you will support this bill with these changes.
Thank you, Mr. Falk. Do any members have any questions for Mr. Falk? Oh, for the director. Okay. Go ahead, Representative Abadji.
Thank you, Chair. For the director, I just kind of, if you could walk us through a little bit more. You know, obviously we're hearing a lot from the testifiers that it's really important that they are able to still get this report done in a way that's not onerous, but it does seem that this is coming in a response to some illegal actions that had happened years ago. And so could you walk us through how someone who is purchasing less than $7.5 million, how you guys would be tracking them to make sure that they themselves also aren't engaging in activity that maybe perhaps wouldn't be caught by a CPA potentially?
Thank you, Representative Abadji. Nick Milanowski.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So under the language here, we would be required to review these statements, whether it's an audit review or any other statement that's submitted to us. These the companies that are purchasing under $7.5 million, they would still be required to report the items that are that start on line 1.1 and continue through 1.16. That would allow us to monitor their financial position, whether we're looking at their current ratio, their balance sheet, whatever that might be. It'll allow us to monitor from year to year and step in if need be. Ultimately, it's far more valuable to monitor these companies individually and look at their progress from year to year rather than compare the huge multi-billion dollar companies of the world to small feed elevators. We are looking at these financial positions. We are also conducting a on-site inspection, and we're trying to make sure that those match. And if we see anything that arises that gives us concern, we'll do what we've done in the past, which is go through our inspection authority, but also recommend if we see any fraud or illegal activity to the local, state, or federal partners that we have that can investigate that. Representative Anderson also mentioned that we have language within the indemnity fund portion of our law, which allows us to go after CEOs, management, or boards of directors in the case of fraud financially for losses to the indemnity fund. So if an elevator were to go insolvent and owe $5 million to farmers, we would pay out the indemnity fund and then seek to recoup those losses from the potential bad actors if there was fraud.
Okay, Representative Abadji.
Yeah, and just one follow-up. So then does the agency then believe then it has enough resources to be able to do this, I guess, at the three tiers that you've now been pulling out, and do you think that you would need more resources in order to be able to like more closely watch all the three tiers of groups that you've specified here?
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's an easy answer. Yes, currently we think we have the appropriate resources for that.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone here in the audience who would wish to testify for or against House File 1063? Not seeing any. Then we'll go to member questions, comments. Representative Lawrence.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And I just, you were asking for more testimony, and so I wanted to jump in as soon as I could. Just in the short time that I've been here, I sent out a message regarding the bill and some of the testimony we heard. One local businessman and feed store in my area came back with the same answer that we've heard testified today, that the requirements have been so burdensome. I'll just read it. He said, I asked, does this legislation affect you? Yes, it would. The financial reporting requirements were so burdensome, I gave up my grain license. Audit level financials for small buyers are very prohibitive, and he found at a cost of nearly $10,000 in his circumstance. So just one more testimony that came through in the short period of time that echoes what was testified today at the table. Thank you for letting me share that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lawrence. We will go to Representative Gander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is really good for me to see the agency right here along with our testifier bringing this bill. Too often we show up and what's the agency stance on this, and we have to try to phone a friend or get someone in, and then to have the testifiers who are also affected by this directly, that brings the whole picture clear, and I do surely hope, I feel like this can be a bipartisan effort that just makes sense to all of us. I do have an email back and forth correspondence to the exact same kind of grain buyer as you have. And so between the additional cost that could be, as you say, $10,000 to $20,000, the time delay and the frustration. You know, the time delay is so significant because he's reaching out over 100 miles trying to find a CPA to do this certified of his financial records that he needs to bring, that the deadline passes for him renewing his license. That's what the time delay does when you're in an area that you can't even find someone to do it. So, yeah, we are squeezing him out. And on the other side of it, I appreciate the other things that you all are doing. So you have enough information garnered to say, yeah, we have proper oversight. So now you have the ability to prevent some of these things before they fall off the cliff and become insolvent. And you're going back and mopping it up afterward to claw back the dollars that you've had to put out to make everybody whole. To me, you're on it as an agency, and this bill just makes really good sense for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gander. We will go to Representative Smith.
Thank you, Vice Chair Harder. I think first, before I do have a question for this, but I want to say, because it's kind of tangential to this, I think part of the difficulty of this bill is CPA availability, and there's need for reform in that area as well, and their licensing requirements, specifically around education requirements. I think it's just worth saying here because it affects certainly this particular bill. But my question specific on this line is probably for the department chair. You can answer if you'd like, because the difficulty that in these questions is a lot of these things in statutes were put in to protect farmers from potential bad actors in the space. And that's also why we did the Grain Indemnity Fund, which is why we're talking about this. But also we want to be sympathetic with what we've already heard from small buyers and not being onerous upon them. So I guess my first question is a big question of how to define what is a small grain buyer and what isn't. And this bill seems to draw a line at $20 million, kind of being that line of big or mid versus small. You're shaking your head. So I just want to give a chance to explain why is that in the language, because we're obviously taking out that $7.5 million. You know what I mean. We're changing some of the requirements around that number and pushing them up to $20 million. So I'm curious, what was the decision like on that particular tier?
Who wishes to answer? Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith. So as we considered this language, we did it with the recommendation from our grain advisory group. We also looked at what other states were doing and the thresholds that they had implemented. This is not a unique requirement. Several other states require that there is financial reporting for their grain buyers. And so we looked at what those requirements were, used that to kind of establish a few separate levels. We also looked at the Small Business Administration to see if that they defined what a small grain buyer was. They did not, unfortunately. But I believe for the industry that was closely related to that, they set that threshold at $38 million. So this is significantly lower than that threshold to define small grain buyers. It is prudent to mention that of the entities that are licensed with us currently that that purchase under $7.5 million worth of grain, there's a considerable number of them. There's about 141 entities. They make up only 0.99% or 1% of all the grain purchases here in Minnesota. The vast majority of grain purchases in Minnesota will be done by companies that are required to have the audit, the highest level financial report. And then there's the review, which falls into about 1.5%. So,
thank you for that, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Vice Chair. That was very helpful. Thank you for that answer. My secondary question is around 2.1 and 2.4, the lines in between there on the actual bill. That's striking out the language about chief executive officers or board designees being able to sign off under penalty of perjury that the financial statement accurately reflects the financial condition of the license. Now that's not putting on any sort of onerous financial burden like maybe the CPA is. So I'm curious why that is being stricken here. I think I heard something to do with the indemnity grain language. I'm curious, is that, so I'll just follow up with that question. If that's the answer, is that still include the term under penalty of perjury in that statute?
Thank you. Who wishes, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Smith. So the yes to the indemnity fund, we can go after the entities for any losses, or sorry, the management or the board of directors for any losses on the indemnity fund. We also struck this from the record because the MDA values a timely report more than a CEO or board of directors certification. So when a entity submits for a review or an audit, the CEO already has to certify those financials as they are going to be audited or reviewed from a CPA. And so they're already doing that. And what we have found over the years since this law went into place is that we saw a significant delay in reporting these financials to us because boards of directors often meet quarterly, semi-annually, sometimes only once a year. And so they were waiting to have these financials signed off certified by those boards before they sent them to us. And so it led to a huge delay in terms of us getting these reports. Our ability to act and step in the case of insolvency or failure to pay it's necessary for it to be a timely response, right? Waiting a year or even several months can mean significantly more losses to these farmers. I will say to the second part of your question, I do not believe there is any threat of perjury under that language in the indemnity fund.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I understand from the department perspective wanting that, but it seems because they're late on reporting, we should take away the requirement to make sure that the board is certifying that everything is financially accurate. Having more eyes on these financial statements is a good thing, and it is not, again, a financial burden on these businesses. Presumably this board is, maybe not always, but they're already part of the budget. So I would be this, Chair, this is generally a good bill. I'm not against this bill at all. But this particular peel back of this requirement doesn't really make sense to me if we want to keep good actors in the space and bad actors out of the space. One clarifying question to the department. You said they are already doing it as far as the CEO signing off on that. Is that not because of this requirement here? And if we take that off, or is that another area that is requiring?
Thank you, Representative Smith. Go ahead, Mr. Milanowski.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, exactly. That is part of the standard good accounting, the standard practice for CPAs. When they are receiving reviews or audits, they require assurances from the CEO or the board of directors as to the accuracy of the financial statement. So these financial statements are prepared internally and then submitted to the CPA or to conduct the review or audit. And so when they are submitting them, they are making the assurances that, yes, we assure that these are accurate. And so it's outside of our process. We don't see that statement, but it's being submitted to the CPAs they're hiring.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Vice Chair. But we're also lifting some requirements around CPAs specifically in this bill. So would that still be true in another license that is reviewing these documents?
Go ahead, Nick.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, for those entities that do not require a CPA, so if they're not doing a review or an audit, no, they would not be making any assurances under this bill.
All right. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Anderson, I'm going to try to make it quick. So
we might come back tonight.
I'll try to be quick. You know, this is kind of the first bill where we have differences of opinion. And, you know, there are differences of opinion everywhere on everything. It is not unanimity is rare. And when there are differences of opinion, you're going to see differences in votes. And by having questions, I think that helps illuminate. So not everything has to be unanimous. And that is a sign of a healthy democracy. I think from our side, you know, if I go through the House research brief, numbers 1, 2, 5, and 6, I don't think there's any problem with. The question comes into 3 and 4, the conforming and what Representative Smith was just asking about, because the difference is with this fund, and when we went from having a bond to having this requirement with the CPA, we've added an indemnity fund, which is funded by the taxpayers, $10 million by the taxpayers. And in all of our districts, we have small businesses that are strapped. We have businesses that fail. We have businesses that have debt. We have businesses that may have fraud. And if we go back to 2018 with the Ashby elevator, the individual, one of the individuals, was an upstanding person in the community. But he filled a machine shed full of taxidermy animals from Africa because he was burning the cash. And we've heard, you know, I think, and many times we hear, I wouldn't say explicitly there, but many times we hear, I didn't know. I didn't know is the reason for something to happen. And by having this requirement and that is being deleted in number 3, I think all of us who work with FSA, we have DocuSigns now. We don't have to wait. We don't have to run in the office. We can get our forms and DocuSign them. We don't have to wait for the board meeting. But when there's a board of directors and a CEO, I wish we could keep that provision that is being deleted in number 3. Because that failure, if those boards are sleeping, if the CEO is sleeping, let's assume the best that they're sleeping. If they're sleeping, then it goes to the taxpayer fund to cover their cost. If they have to sign off on those documents and we can see it, sometimes legally, I'm not sure we've got that many lawyers. Oh, Esther, sorry. Lawyers will find the hole. And Luke, I think Luke too. The lawyers will find the hole where there's a weakness. And having that provision that says that those boards of directors and the CEO have to sign off, I think that provides some protection on responsibility. I think the other question, kind of on the some of the previous questioning, $20 million is a lot of money. It's a lot of money. You know, and I think the 7.5, you know, and understanding that, I thought maybe what we need to do is provide that the state auditor could do the auditing for those who certify that they can't meet the CPA requirements. And the nexus would be that if the failure goes into the indemnity fund, again, $10 million fund that is growing of general taxpayer money from the surplus, the $18 billion, there went $10 million of it, to find some way of providing assistance for those small ones. Maybe we have an even smaller tier that a default is they provide that service could be provided. Because I'm fully aware of CPAs. If you try to get your farm tax accountant passes away and you try to find a new CPA, it's hard. And so it's a problem. But I would just throw that out there. I know that all the folks in the room want to move quickly. Sometimes problem solving takes a little more time. And I would just ask Chair Anderson if we can work with the department on that certification by the CEO and the governing board, because I think that's one thing that sticks. And then that $20 million piece, you know, you have the votes to pass it out of here today, but I think we could get to a good bill if we provided some more protections.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Hansen. Good points. I guess my thought right now is I feel confident that the department says that they feel the wording is adequate, but I will certainly, we can discuss this, but I want to get this bill moving today, and either we come back tonight or we vote immediately, and I would move for a roll call vote, Madam Chair.
Okay, our roll call having been called. Where are we at then? Okay, Chair Anderson, will you please renew your motion?
I renew the motion that House File 1063 be passed and referred to the General Register.
Thank you. The Committee Legislative Assistant will take the roll.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Harder?
Aye.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Agbaje?
Yes.
Representative Burkle?
Yes.
Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Representative Gander?
Aye.
Representative Jacob?
Aye.
Representative Lawrence?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Vang?
No.
With 9 A's and, 4 nays, the bill passes. The motion prevails. The next meeting is Wednesday, February 26th at 1 p.m. There being no further business, this meeting is adjourned.